Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio, LA's new API dealer. And now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mark Rodriguez, and before we get going, I'm going to introduce the guys. Over here on my right is Martin Page.
Hi, Mikey.
And we've got Scott Gershon.
Hello.
And we've got over here on the left, Rob Albertier.
Hello there.
Bobby is not with us.
Again.
Yet again. There is
suspicious.
No, there is no love from Bobby.
Yeah. He's got a better gig, I reckon. He's moved on.
Actually,
more money he's being paid.
That's likely.
That's right. He's podcasting for two Diet Coke.
Horizontal podcasting.
Yeah.
But actually, he's been working a lot, and I can't really give any more details, but I will tell you that his social security number is. No, he's actually a music director for a live show that me and Martin got to see a taping of this past week, and it was pretty cool. He has a really good setup, and I'm sure as soon as it starts airing and he comes back, he's going to give us a whole rundown.
He certainly will.
On what it's like to be a music director for a network television show. Although I will tell you a story. When you talk to him on the phone, he just sounds tired all the time.
Oh, he's exhausted. He's really worked hard on this project. I think it's airing in a couple of weeks, the show.
Yes.
But he put a lot of effort into it, and I think he's got the theme tune as well of the show. I think he wrote the theme tune.
Wow, nice.
He'll have a lot of stories to tell us.
Yeah. I do know a couple times he's told me that he's been writing music in the morning and then going over there and doing
That's
it.
Bobby. Wow. That's Bobby.
That's Bobby.
Yeah.
Good old Bobby.
I think it's just a great excuse for not being with us on the podcast.
A very elaborate excuse.
But before we get going, I just want to mention a few things. Number one, the podcast is doing really great, and I just want to thank everybody out there who's listening. We're already almost over 1,000 listeners, and those are unique listeners.
That's just your family, isn't it?
That's right. That's my family.
Just for 999, yeah.
We're in 13 countries. We just picked up Canada. For some reason, the Canadians are late.
Wonder what that's about.
It's just been going really good, and I just want to encourage you guys out there, if you want to write into us, you can always send us an email at audio@nowcastnetwork.com, or you can go to the website and post some comments, because we're just dying to hear from you guys. If you have any suggestions for shows, hey, suggestions for guests, with all the contacts that we have in this group, somebody's bound to know. Or just if you want to be on the panel, you want to come on in while we're podcasting and you live in Los Angeles or going to be in the LA area, we record every other week, and we can always set that up. So just send us an email if you want to get involved in any way. That's that. Just want to thank everybody out there. And I want to thank you guys on the panel because they're coming here.
Because we're
guys.
Doing such a great job, aren't we? We're bringing the crowds in, Mike.
That's right. That's right. Because I'm out of family members, so. So anyhow, before we get going, today we're going to kind of finish what we started last week talking about songwriting. But before we go on to that, I wanted to tell you guys about something interesting that happened to me and get some feedback from you. I recently changed places where I mix, and I went from a room where I was mixing on Genelex to a room where I'm now mixing on M&K's. It was a really big change. I was amazed at how long it took me to just kind of get a grasp of the room itself. And just thought, you know, I wonder if you guys have ever gone through any of those same type of changes in how you.
I'm actually going through that now, Mike. You know, because I had my analog studio at home, and then I built another room next to it to put a digital studio in, Pro Tools, which you helped me with. And the moment I put even the same speakers I had in the old studio into the new room, it was a totally different picture. And now it's been about, you know, really nearly a year, and I'm still just beginning to get used to it. So I think it's to do with, the, you know, not even the speakers, but the space you're in, you know. If the floor is, you know, not a concrete floor, which I had in my old studio, and the new studio is sort of a floated floor, so instantly everything's different. And it takes real time. You know, the only way you can get through that is giving it a lot of time in a new situation. But it's never the same. You only got to move into, even in a studio, if you walk back 10 feet, everything changes. You know, from where you listen from. So I think it's getting used to that space over a period of time.
Do you have a routine that you go to when you go to a new studio? Because I know you, like Martin, when you're working, or even you, Rob, when you're going to other studios. And Scott, you go to a bunch of different stages when you guys mix your
Every movies. Project I work on is many times is on different stages. Not only that, but sometimes on the same project, will temp the first two temps at two different places and final in a third place. So at that point, everything's different.
I had to actually sit there and bring about five different CDs, and I just listened to them.
That's what you have to do.
I knew really well, and because I was actually having to mix, I came in on a Saturday for a couple hours, and I was mixing Monday, and it was amazing. I mean, even the position of the speakers, even where they were hitting my ears, these are a little higher up and they're angled down. Before, I was used to a really parallel mixing environment where the speakers were just coming at me. I was just amazed at how, you know, when you work in a room where you've mixed for, you know, 9 years, and then you go to a totally different environment.
And you've also got to take out what you mix and put it into your car or something that you really trust, because that's the big thing for me. Is I understand my new room reasonably well, but when I take it out into the car and play in a small space that I totally understand, I start to hear, you know, between CDs that I know and what I'm mixing in the room, it tends to make me realize that what's wrong with my room. By playing it in the car, I think, in the room, I thought I had enough bass. In the car, I haven't. So it's almost like getting a balance between two worlds. You know, I think you've got to, if you're going into a new room and you're not used to it, I think you've got to have several places you can take your first mixes away to get a sense of what that room is, you know, that you're when you come back to it again. Because I now mix a little different, and now in my room I think, I'm hearing a little too much bass. So I'll be aware of that. You know.
And it does take time. I've been in my newer place for 5 years, but I was in my older place for 12 years before that. And when I moved from the old studio to the new studio, I did not change a single piece of equipment. It was the exact same setup in both places. And I did that on purpose because I figured I'd be able to keep working. And you know what? Just the different shape of the room and the acoustics of the room made a huge difference. And I'm talking about the exact same cables. Everything was identical, but the shape of the room really made it so I had to spend about 6 months messing around with it to get comfortable again.
Acoustics is huge. I mean, how do you guys deal with, like, I know in post-production, when we're dealing with 5.1 situations, the biggest problem that we run into is sub. And a lot of times when I'm trying to rock the room and really just put the audience on an e-ticket ride, and we'll design it in my studio, and it's like, wow, this is really effective and impacty, and I just move the room. You take it to one dubbing area. You go, wow, that's not that effective, and it's not hitting as hard as I'd like. And then you adjust it there, and then you go to another place. And I find that every place I go, the subs are radically different, and the acoustics and how they interact with those subs are radically different.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's funny you should say that, because it was the sub that I was really having to grab a hold of, because on the Genelec that I had with the 1031s and their sub, it's such a smooth crossover that you didn't hear where the sub kicked in. Whereas on the M&Ks, I noticed the sub a little more.
You're able to control the sub yourself?
Yeah, well, they have, you know, the thing about the M&Ks is they're very lush and they have a warmth, and I can see why film guys really like them. The Genelecs tend to have that high-end thing, but it's a nice high-end thing. I mean, and when you're working with reality TV and things like that, you really want to hear everything that's there so you know what you need to take out. And the M&Ks, they just make everything sound so good, you know.
Yeah.
And they don't have that high-end thing. So it's getting a hold of the sub that, for me, is what I'm really having to.
You've only been in the room, what, for a week?
You should take some, you know, we spoke about this in a different podcast, but I've got like four different 5.1 systems that I own in different environments that I listen to, and one of them being a dying system, and another one, the sub is actually a oh, and I just forgot what that was. I love that.
It'll come to you in the
show. It will come. You know, I'll be sitting on the toilet somewhere and be like, oh, I remember it. You know, I'll be like, but it's bag ends.
Don't call us when
that happens. But one thing I've noticed is that, oh, yes, hey.
Can we get a toilet in here? Get through this?
So the dines, what they're doing is going for bass extension. And what they're looking is like for the bass guitar or something just to keep the same kind of sonic quality as the main speakers, but just being able to go all the way down. The bag ends are somewhere in the middle, but they have a wonderful punch. Then when you look at folded speakers in theaters, what I found is that they're just rumble. Mm-hmm. If you want a big impact, it's a whoa, rather than a buh.
Yeah.
So it is interesting in looking at those three different speakers. that how they totally react different. And, you know, I guess the old age question is, what do you mix for?
Yeah, and you try to find a middle ground. I know I do. I try to find the middle place. And that's quite a strange thing to say. But I don't mean middle in the sound of middle, but I try to think, what's a good overall vibe here? Because I don't quite understand the room at this moment, and then I'll take it out quickly.
Mike, have you thought about also bringing in some Genelux in the room temporarily in addition to the M&Ks, switching back and seeing how the differences translate?
You know, that's a good idea. And if I owned a pair of Genelux, because the only other speakers that I know really well.
Oh, you're
well,
a pro audio dealer. Right?
Are my S3As, which are great speakers. So, I mean, those things are just awesome.
Yeah.
There's a big plug for Adams, but they're awesome. Anyhow, but that's definitely – it would be interesting to grab.
I got to ask you, the first things you've done in the studio in the week, have you liked how it's come out when you've taken it outside? Or have you heard that you're still fighting it?
No. I've been pretty happy with what's come out of the room. It's just, you know, when you move to a new environment, you still have that. You're just a little – it's like you're a little unsure all the time. Mm-hmm. It's like we're walking on ice. That any minute, you know, you're just wondering if you're going to slip. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's been some little – small little things that have happened. But all in all, it's a terrific room. It's a bigger room. And there's – the M&Ks are definitely there. You know, they're a great speaker. You don't hear a lot about them, but when people talk about 5.1, you know, they're usually one of the first speaker systems that come out. But I will tell you, too, the other thing that I want to mention is it really showed me how well I knew my old room.
Yeah.
And people, you know, there's a lot of guys out there that seem to be changing, you know, their studios as much as they change their clothes, because every time you go visit them at their home studio, you know, their speakers are now here. Mm-hmm. Now their speakers are there. I mean, I'm sure you all have friends like that. And there's something
that's one of the things I won't change around. I'll leave. I may change everything else in the room, but once the listening position is good.
And I have friends where I go to their studio and they're always changing. And you just want to tell them, listen, leave it alone. Just learn your room. You know, I mean, you can fix it. You can, you know, trap your bass, do everything you need. But there comes a point where it's about making music. It's about getting to work. And then when your room becomes just like a second. You know, second nature to you, because I was, you know, mixing 8 hours a day over at this other place, and I knew I could just sense, like, as soon as 2K was getting away from me, I just boop, you could just hear it, and you just, it's no problem.
I do have a question here for you.
Sure.
You know, as we all watch TV and we see the volumes, like Fox is way loud, you know, and I find that I've got my remote and I'm actually mixing between my commercials and the show. I'm actually mixing on my TV. What is zero for you?
Well,
and what do you reference your room at?
Well, see, that's
85, 82, 80.
Well, you can reference 85, although a lot of guys are working in small rooms, and if you reference it 85, it's way too loud. I mean, I can go up to 85, but the rooms that I've, especially the room that I mixed in before this one, mm-hmm. if I referenced it 85, I'd be deaf by now.
So what do you reference to?
Oh, I was probably about a good 10 dB lower than that, because it was a smaller,
75?
Yeah, about 75, 76.
So when you're hitting it hard.
Oh, when you hit it hard. But the thing about television is you live and die by your meters.
So when you're zero, obviously zero used to be minus 20. Are you elevating
my
those levels?
My zero is minus 20. It's still minus 20.
But if you elevate it, because what's happening now is there is no reference level on TV.
Let me tell you, here's the thing. Two things are happening. Number one, you look at Discovery Channel, and they did something really kind of cool. Dolby has the LM100 or LM1000. Andrew. LM100, LM1000.
LM100.
There you go.
Andrew, all right.
Andrew's the engineer, but he also worked with me over at the other place. And he was the engineer there too. So they have this box where it will measure the relative loudness of the dialogue as you're mixing. And you've got to hit target points that they tell you on the spec where it is. And it's a real-time dialogue analyzer. Basically, it analyzes the frequencies where dialogue sits. And it has to peak, and it has to be in a certain area. That keeps all their shows, and they're really strict about it, sounding all level. But the problem that you have is that's for their program, but the commercial guys don't have to follow that. So I don't know, but Fox is a good example. You watch The Simpsons on Fox, right? and this, it's going along, it's going great. I love The Simpsons, by the way. And all of a sudden their commercials come on or their promos come on?
Yeah.
Forget it. All bets are off.
Or better yet, have you gone from HBO to Fox? Because HBO is truly minus 20. It's, I'm cranking up my home theater system like, this is great, and I'm watching, you know, Sopranos and Deadwood and all this. And then they go, hey, let me jump to Fox. And then, at that point, the drapes start moving, the couch moves back, It's super loud.
I was mixing the Adam Carolla show, and we were having a heck of a time with the LM100 and just getting it all set up. But when it worked, it weren't, as much as I was kicking and screaming like a lot of other mixers, it was working really well, and it really it gave a consistency to the channel, to everything. The only thing I didn't get is they dinged me a couple times because it was too low, and then I watched the program, and there was no dialogue.
Wow.
So I'm like, okay, how do I bring up silence again? But, there's a big push in just trying to get some consistencies. And if you go on, like, the DigiBoard, the post-production, area, there's a lot of threads on the LM100. And actually, a guy from Discovery posted on the board and a reply on why they do that. And
what the dynamic range that Discovery's trying to hit?
I have no idea.
Welcome to the Mike Rodriguez Show.
But one thing we do a lot of.
He asked me a question.
Yeah, but that's 3 hours, Mike.
Do you think now with HD digital audio that the compressions are all going to go away?
I have no idea. That would be interesting.
Let's talk about composition and music.
Well, anyhow, that was a nice little detour.
Why talk about music when we can talk about how loud it is?
Wait a second.
I like square, just square waveforms.
I like
just
really
goes
loud
up.
Music. Yeah.
You got to be able to feel it.
Oh, let's not talk about music and compression.
No,
that's a whole nother show. That's amazing because usually it's Rob that takes us off in those tangents.
I know. I'm just sitting here.
Well, I felt that I had to give Rob a break. So
I ran out of breadcrumbs about 15 minutes ago. I had no idea where we were going.
Okay. I just sent in there a big edit.
No, you got to keep that in, Mike. That's great.
It is good stuff.
No, it is.
The
it
Canadians
is.
Will demand it, Mike. The, leave it in.
The Canadians will demand it. But we'll see now.
Actually, for this podcast and all the people from different countries, I would like to ask people if they could submit to the website, all the people that are in this business, what the different countries and what your zero point is, and where do you find that your dialogue lives in your mixes. Let's put that out there for everybody who's listening.
Goodness gracious.
I think Scott just started Headroom Palooza in 2006.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I think for the four people out there that just understood that, and that let's go for it.
MTV's going to be all over this.
I see it already.
Well, it's issue. There was a
Calm down.
Calm to DVD.
There was a audio sound design forum on Yahoo Groups, and I put that out there because somebody made a remark, and I said, "What do you guys find zero is?" And next thing I know, I'm getting stuff from India, France, Germany, people that I'm like, "Wow." So it's amazing to actually see how the different countries and even the people in this country are, what their standards or non-standards are.
You're going to get an amazing response.
You know what?
This,
how funny would that be if we actually did that?
I bet you do.
You probably will.
Yeah.
So, Martin and I won't be back next week. Is that happening?
Welcome to Post-Production Forum.
Yeah, really.
That's right.
The ones that made fun
you know
of
what? Scott, we're going to have our own show and talk post-production.
That's just, okay, I'm going to put my music hat on.
It's just going to have to be that way. But
I'm going straight back to my studio and I'm going to check out the levels and the VU meters and all that kind of stuff. I'm going to become a number man.
Well, question is, I'm the same thing. Where do you like to stick your vocals?
I have no bloody idea, man. I fell asleep 20 minutes ago.
I will say this. I'm guilty of this. I've done just some side mixing for friends who were doing documentaries and things like that. And when it came time to lay it back and pick a master level, we basically went to a really high-end post place, had them play us some stuff that sounded really good, and made ours match level-wise. I figure if they're doing stuff that's going to be on HBO and it sounds amazing, if mine lines up you know, it's just like listening to your song after you do it against other songs that are going to be on the radio.
It's exactly it's the just same. Yeah, mastering, it's exactly the same. You know, how loud do you get before you start to lose the quality of the songs, right. You know, and the musicality. And then I think that's we're talking all about the same thing, really.
And you know? I do admire the people who know at what numbers all of that stuff happens, but I just that's just not where I spend my time.
Yeah. Okay, you are tonight, though.
Okay,
man.
I'm the geek of the group, then. You know?
Absolutely.
I just mix till QC bumps it back, and then I just remix.
Yeah.
It's a good point, though, because people are accepting it at music at such a level now. And it's like got louder and louder and louder, and it's almost impossible to take sometimes. I was at the movie yesterday, and they were putting, that same as you were saying about TV, the adverts before the film were
it's
extremely loud. And it's so bright and so crisp that people, I was noticing, were, you know, putting their hands up to their ears. It was just so loud.
You know what actually would then be interesting is to get a mastering engineer in here. Mm-hmm. And because, like, well, we're talking about film and post-production, and we're saying everything's all over the place, and in TV... Obviously, when I grew up with TV, you had to take, like, licensing, you know, the broadcast licenses, and it was really difficult, and there was a lot of school. Now it's just all gone. Yeah, so the question, I guess, would be, with all these people in recording studios, and especially home studios, these poor mastering engineers are coming in, and they've got to make everything kind of feel similar. What are they getting, and what's their perspective of this business going, everyone thinks they got low end, there's no low end, or they're hitting too much low end, or... it's too loud or it's too not loud enough or...
There's a great deal of articles in the music magazines now, particularly about that from mastering engineers, what they're dealing with. And most artists are coming in saying, make me louder. You know, I don't care how it sounds, make me compete. And the mastering engineers are frustrated because, you know, they're losing a lot of what the music is. Even now jazz artists are coming in saying, we must be louder, you know. Yeah. And so, you know, you're dealing with that losing the musicality of the music because it gets over-compressed and you lose any dynamic at all. And it also gets tiring hearing.
And the detail, one of the things I've noticed, even in both music and post-production, is sometimes when we've lowered the subs or brought the whole mix down. I mean, I even agree. You go to theaters, it's played. Some of the stuff's wicked loud. And I find that when you bring it back, all of a sudden, the stuff appears.
You hear things.
Because your ears are compressing, and it's just not allowing you to hear certain things. Mm-hmm. Then when you start hearing mixes that are a little more at the right level, whatever all of a sudden, everything opens up. You start hearing all these things you've never heard before.
I have a question for you. On the big stages, do they ever lower their volume when they're mixing, or do they always mix at a consistent level? Like when I'm mixing, I can lower my volume if I wanted to hear, like a DVD thing, and I lower the volume because I want to – if it's too loud, you know, and I just – my ears are getting fatigued, I'll lower it, and I can actually hear a lot of the balance a lot better, lower volume. Do they ever do that on the big stages?
Well, you know, what I've – because I'm trying to create a standard right now in the gaming world for mixing. And what I've found is that dialogue lives only in about a 6 to 8 dB range. Anything outside that is either going to be too loud and sibilant or too low and I can't understand it. Dialogue's got a very, very small dynamic range. So once you find out where dialogue lives, then it's the artistry to figure out, is the music going to be louder? Is it going to be softer? So that's kind of the line of where you put it. If you want to, you know, giant earthquakes and starships are coming in and lasers are going, well, yes, it's going to be as loud as you can get it.
But if you're getting ear fatigue, you will dim the main monitor.
But will they ever dim the main monitor? That's what I'm asking. In the big state, like when you're at Universal, will they ever just go over there and dim the main monitor?
We dim sometimes in pre-dubs, but when the client's there, you know, it is a problem. No, they don't. Most of the mixers – it depends on the mixers, but 9.9% of the time, because it's 85 dB. That's the theater. Right. What I find is you'll do a mix, then we'll take an hour break for dinner because we're going all day long. You come back and you go, whoa, God, that's loud.
Yeah, totally.
Meanwhile, when you've been working, because you got to remember, we work on a 10-minute sequence, can take 2 days on 10 minutes. So we're and it could be like a battle sequence, and it's bashing. And also, when they hit play, there's no ramp up. It's wham, everything's on. So, you know, it depends also on the director. Some directors go, you know, could we try it? Certain mixers that I work with, if given the opportunity, I actually try to dim it down about the 6 to 10 dB down just to see what's there, to see what we're hearing, to make, because I can hear balance better at lower volumes than at louder volumes. When it's loud, it's cool, it's fun, but I'm not really sure what's happening.
It's an interesting thing that you're saying that, because I don't know if anybody knows, they'd probably find this interesting, but, you know, Mutt Lang, when he was mixing all of the Def Leppard's records, and we always think of them as such, you know, heavy metal volume, and he was mixing them on the smallest speakers you could find, almost car speakers, the whole album with Mike Shipley. I mean, literally.
Really?
Yeah, a whole year was on small speakers. So
it's amazing, because that stuff sounds loud even when it's soft, which is great.
That's what he believed as well. You know, if you mix it loud, if you mix it low, but it sounds powerful low, it's going to be amazing at a higher
volume.
And
I would also imagine with subs and music, because a lot of people now are, you know, with their iPods, and are getting, you know, stereo with a sub, and it all works together. A lot of times when you're mixing, you go, God, this is great, it's powerful, and oh, and then you turn the sub off, and you go, wow, it's thin, it's brittle, there's nothing there. So a lot of times, you know, I like, whether I'm doing music or I'm doing in post, I actually like to shut the subs off and see what I got to say, okay, that's what TV is going to sound like. That's what a lot of, you know, industries are going to sound like. I just want to understand what I've got. Am I still punchy? Am I clear?
It's pretty amazing, really, because the subs weren't really involved for, you know, when I'm thinking about the 70s and 80s when we were working so consistently, I didn't see many subs in where we were working.
Well, bass was invented in 1997.
Thanks, Mike. Because I've never heard bass, ever. No, but it's like, you know, now it's everybody talks about having subs.
Because you want to feel it. I mean, we felt it in rock concerts. That's what was always great. Yeah. You go to the rock concerts and you know, the drummer starts off with a couple kick drum hits, and everyone went, oh my God,
vomit.
The whole place just moved.
No, that was the guy behind you doing his foot.
You know what, though? The phenomenon of getting us – the phenomenon.
It's because you haven't spoken for a while.
Well, thank you. The phenomenon is phenomenal. Of getting a sub for the first time. I actually only got a sub for my studio about 2.5-3 years ago.
It's a year for me, yeah.
But it's one of these things where as soon as you get it, then you wonder how you ever didn't have it.
Yeah.
But –
it does come down to the room, though.
It definitely comes down to the room. And we still mix, for the most part, with the sub off.
Good.
And then just check it with the sub on. And then when people come over and you want to impress them, you play stuff with the sub on.
But if you're doing urban music or hip-hop or anything of that, you're definitely using the sub.
Yeah, but you got to make sure your mixes sound good without it. Otherwise, you can have something that sounds amazing with the sub, and you shut off the sub, and you have no kick drum.
And you get so excited when you first put the sub on.
Yeah.
You have to really sort of just get that sub just touching, because, you know, before I had somebody work with me on it, I had it up much too loud because it just made me feel good. But it wasn't true at all.
Isn't it interesting, though, when you look at – I've been listening to some 70s mixes. And, you know, the kick's, like, barely there. The vocals are up front.
Yeah.
And there's, strange enough, not a lot of low end. Mm-hmm. And then you listen today, and, you know, drums are more prevalent. Bass is way more prevalent. So there's bass guitar if it's the right kind. It's just interesting to hear the differences of mixes.
It's funny. I hear it differently. I hear more bass in
more
the older records. Yeah.
Really?
I find in the new records, they just sound incredibly overcompressed and thin and lack just that underbelly. But if I go back and listen to Avalon or Earth, Wind & Fire or even Quincy Jones' records, I go, God, they really looked for the bass properly.
Well, you're right, because that form of music, I was thinking more of the rock, but yeah, absolutely.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no. I know what you're saying.
Earth, Wind & Fire, But those bands had a ton of dynamics.
Yeah.
And really took
but,
advantage
of it. I think
it's
a good point, though. I don't think people are mixing quite like that these days. And they're so used to the Pro Tools, and they're so used to using the Waves compressors that everything gets flattened out.
And distressed.
Every rock band sounds the same. The guitars are just a wall of kind of flimsy, just flat, you know, electric sort of hum, buzz. Yet if you go back and you listen to Led Zeppelin, you go, God, was I listening to a room or what? You know, I can hear the bass amplifier in the room. I can hear the drummer's ambience. And there's a lot of that being lost because it's beautiful we can do a lot of stuff at home, but it's also making us not really look at the energy of what a band is brought together with a great engineer in a good studio and just picking up the performance as it happens. I've got at home, I've got my iPod in my kitchen where I'm, you know, I'm making a cup of tea and I just have the iPod on the Bose little system there. And you can hear some of my favorite records. You can hear the bass coming through so much better than what a lot of the new records are. You listen to Coldplay and you go, great, terrific. But you get a feeling with Coldplay. the songs are great, but you get a feeling that it's a little flat and a little thin, but it's been worked on. Then you listen to something, say, for instance, you know, Thin Lizzy from back then, and you go, boy, I can hear those Marshall amps really pumping, you know. It's just our mentality over the years has got a little bit more cheaper in the way we're doing things.
Well, you also have those the plugins that give you the low subharmonics that people like to put on their bass to get even more even
but it's
more
not,
bass.
But it's not a real bass.
Yeah, that's
you know
just
what I mean.
It.
You can tell it's not a real bass. You go, it's there, but you don't feel it.
And if you're listening to it on like those little Bose things, where you know there's a certain bass roll off, and it'll just go to mush, you know, below yeah. that one. Yeah. Whereas if you listen to Earth, Wind, and Fire, and you practically could, you know, you hear
you
the bass
it.
So well, you can see the round strings.
Yes, you
like,
can.
That's flat
you
round.
Can.
Oh, that's round round.
That's very
you know
true.
What I'm saying?
Very,
you,
very true.
And you hear the air within it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey, listen, guys, as exciting as this conversation is, and actually it's pretty good, the whole level thing. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we're actually going to get back to the original topic we were supposed to talk about, which is demoing out your song, part two of the songwriting little clinic we're doing. All right, so we'll see you on the other side.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And I know you guys just really enjoyed that first riveting half hour. No, actually, really, you brought up some good points, Scott, with the levels, because it seems like everything is really hot nowadays, and everybody's just pushing for just as much volume as you possibly can, which I'm going to segue into what we want to talk about, and that's demoing your song. Last week, Martin, you gave some really great advice, also you too, Rob, about inspiration, and the one thing I really like is coming up with the lyric by scatting along, and the lyric just kind of falls into your mentally. So once you've gotten your song, you're ready to record. Martin, how do you demo out your songs? I mean, where do you start? And when you demo your songs, are you demoing with a specific production target? Do you want it to sound as close to the end product as possible? And what are some of the challenges that you face with some of that type of stuff?
I've always seen my demos as mini records, really. Like, as near as I can get to the demo sounding like a record, because a lot of my songs that I wrote in my studio ended up being the masters, because you get these performances and this kind of free playing when you're doing a demo that you never really get when the red light goes on and you think you're doing something even more special. So I've always thought as the demos happen to be really, really impressive, more in my early days to impress A&R men for certain artists. But I've always thought that the best job you can do on the demo to really illustrate what you're going for is really important. I'll tend to do a very rough sketch, maybe even on a cassette player, to get the arrangement. Because I think for many writers, especially writers that are starting off, you don't know how to edit yourself, and you make a demo too quickly. You start recording and actually tidying up a song that really isn't a great song. I think the key is, over a number of years, I've learned to go very, very slow and precise first on the arrangement. You know, do you need a middle eight? Do you need two verses? Where does the chorus come in? And keep knocking that out rough in a very small form.
So you'll actually take like a cassette deck or
sure.
something, and then with just a piano, and you just work out your arrangements before you even...
Totally. Totally.
Even though it's your home studio and you can do as much as you want, you might as well get the song down right, I guess. Right?
Yeah, you know, because I think there's a real good chance that you're going to start, you go towards your Pro Tools and you go towards your drum machine and you start becoming a producer much too fast. You know, you have to first be the writer. And for me, you know, even a couple of months ago, I went searching for a little remote cassette player and everybody's saying, oh, you know, you won't be able to buy a cassette player anymore. You should be doing this on digital, you know, and this and that. And I wanted a cassette player because I could treat it very roughly, take it into the different rooms in my house, and when I'm shaving in the morning, I can just be playing it. And the rougher the better, so I can hear if the melody's good and whether the guitar in the background or the piano is sounding good, you know. I sometimes, you know, go towards Pro Tools to get a pad sound or to get an atmosphere going or a rhythm going. But I'm very aware that some of the things I did when I was first starting to write was, and I think a lot of writers run into this problem, is that you're producing something much too quickly when you haven't found the fundamental strength of a song. Well, this comes over a number of years, you know, that you, because when you first start, I think I said it in the first show, you tend to just want to get a result. You know, oh, I've written a song. I started it, I got a middle and I got an end. It's done. But over a period of time, you realize that that song's not going to possibly have the magic it needs. So that cassette, eventually, when I feel maybe over a period of 2 days, even playing it in the car as I'm driving around, I think this is a good structure. This is a strong skeleton. This is a very, very solid place to start. I'll then move towards the Pro Tools and look at the... I've always seen songs as though you're building a human being. I've always seen it like, you know, you've got the head is the melody, the chest is the chords, and the legs are the groove and the rhythm and the bass and the structure. So I think I try to build my own Frankenstein to say this is a very solid, great melody, got the head, chest is good, the chords are good, the progressions are good, and the legs has got a great groove, the bass line's right, the drums are doing what they should do. And when that's how I proceed, really, from a very rough structure of trying to build a human being up towards the production with Pro Tools. And then when I'm going towards Pro Tools, my next thought is I'm now making the record. I don't think it's a demo. I think I'm making a record.
See, that's really great because how many times do you hear someone's song and it's really great production and they've recorded it really well, yet the song is just horrible.
It's most of what's on the radio right
now.
But
that's really cool because if you get your arrangement down, especially if you force yourself on a little cassette deck where you know you're not going to use that in your demo.
Right.
It's just going to be purely you can use the idea. And you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, what if you get in the moment and you want to be spontaneous and you want to do that? But from talking to a lot of songwriters and especially talk to you, sometimes you get that little wisp of inspiration, and that's the structure of the song. But rarely, I mean, most of the time, you know, when you're creating a song, it's like creating a painting. It's just a process that you've got to go through, and you got to take it step by step by step. I mean, every once in a while, magic does happen, but maybe the magic is in the whole process. So I think that's really great. You know,
it doesn't. And I'm really talking from my heart and truthfully here. I think when you first start writing, you don't know that too well, so you go forward much too quickly. And you know, sometimes the cassette player or even the four track that you're working on in a rough form is really, really useful because you've got to have the great vision to say, this is the first rough. There's a microphone in the room, and I don't care how rough it sounds. I'm concentrating on the melody, the phonetic vocals. You know, even if you haven't got the words, do go very guttural at the beginning, and it'll still speak to you. You know, it's easy for me to say this because I've been doing this for many years. But when you first start, it's very hard for people to grasp that because they don't want to hear their stuff on a cassette. They want to get to the next stage. They want to get to the reverbs. They want to hear the drum machine. They want to hear this and that, and they want to get themselves singing on a good microphone. And that it's even better for me now because I think when I've got something that's good rough on a cassette player, I can't wait to take it to the next stage. It's like now the doors have opened. Your home studio's ready, the guitars are tuned up. We know we got a strong skeleton. We know we have a good body to build on. That's how I work anyway now.
When you write, are you thinking like vocal melody and then you'll build the rhythm section and the body of it around that? Or do you hear a rhythm and then build, you know, what is your procedure in doing that?
It can be very different ways. Sometimes I can start with a drum machine rhythm, and that sets you, when you play on the piano or a guitar, it starts you off in a certain place because those drums are leading you a certain way. Or if you just pick up an acoustic guitar and your rhythm of your hand on the strings will start your voice singing a certain way. I tend to not know what's about to happen. I tend to go, I might be in the mood to write a moody song, a ballad song, or I might be in the mood to say, hey, let's get the rhythm up and let's try something tribal and see where it goes from. It's a great process of jamming for me. Mainly I'll find out of a day or 2 days, nothing worthwhile has happened. And as Mike was pointing out, I'll find that I'll do maybe an hour on 8 bars that I'm getting together. And then I think, I can't get any farther. And I better stop on this one and walk away from it. Because very, very rare that you get a whole song appear straight away. It has its own way of living. It has its own way of coming to you. You just have to have the stamina to know, to keep going with it, and to also over a period of time to know if that idea is worth pursuing. Another point is some people will say, I've got an idea, I'm going to see it through to the end, when really you should be able to say, it's not a very good idea, it's not sitting very good, let me move on to something new. That's that big word that we've talked about in the last show, editing yourself, you know, and not believing everything you do, as Rob brought up, is great.
Now, how important do you think it is to be a great player, a writer, be a great player?
I don't think it's really important to be a really great player. I think you need to know you have the mechanics. You need to know how to play an instrument reasonably well. You know, you need to be, for me personally, I'm a bass player, and that's what I'm best at playing, because I learned in groups to be just a musician in a band. But I learned to play keyboards to learn the chords. I'm not a good keyboard player, but I know how to get around the chords, and I know what I'm dealing with. Same with guitar. I can play, but it's just a standard. For myself, I'm looking for melody more than anything else, and character, that you write, you know, when you listen to a simple song, say My Sweet Lord by George Harrison, or you listen to Amazing Grace, you know that you're listening to something very simple but is very poignant. And I think the simple songs are always the hardest to write. So I don't think you have to be a great musician. It certainly helps. You've certainly got to learn your tools. You've got to know how to, I think in today's age, you've got to learn how to use Pro Tools to a certain degree. But this is another good point you brought up is, if you learn too much, you don't create. Because you can keep on going learning.
That's the point I was going to make, is that in the old days, writing a song, there weren't that many different instruments at most people's fingertips. Now, in most studios, I mean, the writing process is different depending on the kind of song you're writing. I tend to write very melodic stuff too, but there are plenty of people who are doing trance tracks where there may not be a melody and it might just be groove, whatever.
Yeah.
I think that now most people, with any kind of writing setup, even a little tiny setup in a laptop in the living room, have so many sounds and so many tools at their disposal. I don't know about you, but I find when I want to really be creative and write a song, I need to shut most of that stuff
off
and out of my brain space completely. You need to limit your tools. Otherwise, the whole writing process ends up being about going through a million tools, looking for a million sounds.
It's a huge thing today. It's a huge thing. You can go.
It's way too easy.
You go, should we learn Logic? Should we learn Cubase? Should we learn Pro Tools? Then we're going to go and learn GarageBand. You go, hey, you know, I'm going to die before I learn all this. Yeah. You've got. It's great to learn the rudiments and then go, have to shut down now because I know I can get the pads. I understand a drum machine. I can get something recorded. I can get something through the microphone onto tape. And, you know, otherwise you will not create.
Yeah, you've got to limit your tools. You can't. Totally. You can't expect, I mean, I have billions and billions of sounds at this point. There's no way. I mean, if I set out to say, okay, I'm now going to write the greatest song, so I have to go through my billion sounds and find the greatest kick and the greatest snare and the greatest whatever.
Isn't it great, though, when what we're talking about? Because when you've written the song and you think, okay, I've got the good basics here.
Oh, then.
Now let's go looking for the sounds.
Absolutely. That's production. That's not writing. And they're two very different things.
Okay, well, you know what? That's a great segue, because now let's go to production, okay? We've got the little cassette and we've edited ourselves and we've figured out our arrangement. Now we're going to go into production, and right now production I think is a really big stumbling block for a lot of people, because I hate to say it, but a lot of times, especially if you want to start selling your songs, you got to really have great production. At least that's the way I perceive it, that people want to hear absolutely as close to radio ready as possible.
Well, because people don't have an imagination,
right.
And they're hearing enough other stuff that's radio ready that you got to be there.
Now you're going into production. Tell us a little bit about some of your experiences as far as getting songs into A&R people and getting songs into the people that make the decisions for the artists that they represent. Do you find you're seeing people that have less of a creative ear, meaning they can't see potentials of the song so that they'll want it laid out right in front of them in full production?
It's interesting what we were saying in the first part of the show. I think technology has changed so much quite rapidly over the last, you know, 2-3 years, that even A&R men are expecting, you know, the CD to be the record. You know, sometimes they're hoping that the demo you bring in is the record, and can they put their singer on the track. And, you know, your CD has to compete with, as we were talking about, even now, it's like, you know, we want to have a loud CD so that it competes with what everybody else is bringing in, because technology has allowed us to bring up the dynamics of stuff. But it's still basically the same. The A&R department are still looking for that song they think is a hit for their artist, for their movie, for whatever they're involved in. So it really is very true that even though I'm an artist as well, and I'm writing songs for myself, that even when I'm writing for somebody else or for A&R Men, you do tend to think that this must sound pretty phenomenal. It has to sound as good as what they might be buying down the shop, you know. So you have to think that all the time. Even if you're doing, you know, a Johnny Cash kind of song where you're trying to feel like we get the real raw elements and we want to simulate that this is done in, you know, somebody's barn or whatever. You have to be doing that really well. You know, you have to have a good microphone. You have to have a good mixer. You know, you have to be, for me as a songwriter, I had to be an all-rounder. I had to understand how to mix to a certain degree, how to engineer to a certain degree, how to play most of the instruments quite well. I knew I had to take an overall view of making a record. So I think that, you know, some of the most successful songwriters that have their material recorded, they're songwriters, they're musicians, they're technicians, and they're producers. Not doing it all wonderfully well, but having a wonderful overview. You know, I learned pretty early on, and I think my success in L.A. happened a great deal because I was, in a way, a kind of producer to my demos.
I think that gives you a big leg up.
It does, Rob, yeah. Does.
I will say this. In my experience, I've found there are two ways to get A&R people to basically go for material. One way is, yes, you do the full production and you basically hand them something that sounds like a record. That way they don't have to have any imagination or do any work, and away you go. The other option, though, is to deliver the song in its simplest, purest form, like just a piano, just a guitar, maybe even just an a cappella vocal if it's a strong enough song. Because at that point, it's better to do that, I've found, than to have mediocre production. It's better to let them just hear the soul of the song, the real meat of the song, and imagine whatever kind of production they might want to put to it for whatever kind of artist they're thinking about. By giving them just a piano and a voice, or a guitar and a voice, or something very simple like that, if it's a strong enough song, that can sell the song.
This is a very good point you bring up, because I've recently been, you know, involved with writing for Josh Groban again on his new record, and I've had to re-demo a very simple song that really just had a voice and a nylon guitar five times. And the artist would just make, without me meeting the artist, the A&R person would say, I've had a word with him, he's heard the song, we would like this lyric changed, and can you do it again, just to put some strings in the bridge and whatever. So I think we're talking about both things at the same time. I brought in something which was very raw and very tempting, especially to an artist like Josh Groban, where you could hear the simplicity. But I was forced to, as Mike knows, rewrite this song three or four times and to become a little grander as I went along, you know.
But at least it continues the conversation. As long as they're on the hook and want to talk about it, you're doing well.
Totally right.
Yeah, but now you, at one point you said that a lot of times your demos become actually the actual tracks. We were talking before that one of the things that's changed over time, say between the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, is that it used to be that we captured a performance. Yeah. That you always hear the stories about the bands that said, oh, I was tinkering on the guitar, and I came with this cool little lick, and I did this little drum thing, and all of a sudden this magic appeared. Now it seems that things are becoming more manufactured, sometimes by one person. Sure. So there's only one perspective on it. What do you think about, you know, because obviously all of us aren't exceptional at all the instruments, but hearing that one little bass lick, that one little something that each person brings that's unique, what are your feelings on both of you about that?
I think it's rarer and rarer now because of what you just said.
I think we kind of whined about that in the last podcast a little bit, about how it used to be just about capturing that performance, and I remember harping on the idea that there's no reason it shouldn't be about that now. Just because you have tools that make it easy to record a billion takes and then tune them and fix them doesn't mean you have to work that way. I think the best songs, the best productions, are still the ones where you feel like you captured humans doing something really cool, like you captured a real performance. And there's, even though these new tools give you a million options to fix things, it doesn't mean you have to. I mean, the best performance is still a great thing.
It's an interesting thing. You know, as Rob was saying, I think that you look at Trevor Horn's productions, which have always been very sophisticated and always leaning on bringing in the new technology, even Peter Gabriel's. But there seems to be a great sense of the mentality that we're trying to do something very unique and capture some emotion there. You know, and I think it really comes down to, you know, as Rob says, you know, that still thinking you can do it with the tools you've got now. But I do believe it's not as prevalent now as it was back in, say, the 80s and 70s. And we brought up in one of the really early podcasts we did about, you know, what the Beatles were dealing with, and Jeff Emerick, who did all those great records with them, and Sgt. Pepper. And he has a problem with it. You know, you can read, when you read it in his book, it's a big problem that it wasn't about bringing four musicians into the space and the air and saying, we're all in the vibe, let's all play and see if we can get something magic happening now. I think it's much easier, and this is it, it's easier to say, let's just do the drums, let's just do the pad, now let's have the singer come in. And in that, it takes a tremendous skill to make that still sound like it's got something unique, because we're escaping in the things to do one man does everything.
Well, as a producer, when doing the demos, do you have an arsenal of musicians that have an interesting little quirk that you think would be perfect for this one demo to best show off? I mean, the song's already written, but you want to really now make it a little special.
You know, I'm guilty of it. I'm guilty of, when I'm doing songs for other people, I tend to think, I'll do it all, and I'll play everything. I won't involve anybody else. I'll try and get that magic myself. But because I'm doing a solo album now at this time, I do want to have performances. I tend to look at it a little differently and say, we do want a live drummer. I do want to have guitarists play on 8 tracks and feel free and turn the lights down and get the emotion, and then I'll work around that and try and pull in some other magic. I am guilty when I'm writing for other people of thinking, I can basically do all this myself. And I'll try and find that little magic myself. But
you're not alone there. I mean, it's a natural temptation. I think what makes a great producer is when you realize just what's best for the project and you step outside of that. I mean, I'm guilty of trying to do everything myself too, but if I'm doing a song that needs to be a huge production and I just put down a Kunga track, well, yeah, I can use my Kunga track, or I can hire a friend who has dedicated his life to being a Kunga player. It's going to be a lot better. So my track might be passable, but his is going to be amazing.
Bobby does that a lot, though. He has a nice...
Yeah, Bobby loves to bring in real players. Purely for that vibe that you were talking about, that he has camaraderie in the studio.
Oh, it's the best.
And people are throwing down ideas that you would never maybe do yourself. And it takes you back a little bit to that time when there were bands recording together with an engineer and the vocals were going down the same day, you know.
Yeah, and that was good.
Yeah.
That was not just old. That was good.
Exactly.
Well, let me ask you a question. When you're starting your demo, like, so somebody's written the song, they've captured the magic, they've done all the steps, and now they're demoing out, they've done the little cassette, now they're ready to go into production, they start production. Do you demo differently for where you're going to target your demo for? Meaning, like, if you're going to go for A&R because you want to sell the song, do you push the vocals maybe a little bit more, and or do you try to want to give them an overall production of the whole number with the vocals?
You know what? You just pointed out probably the biggest flaw in all the demos I get and hear from people is they hide the vocals. As if that's not the most important thing. As if the melody isn't the most important thing.
So, I mean,
what's your take on that?
Well, I'm at the moment I'm making my next solo record, so I'm very involved with just trying to get the heart and soul of truth across and my own style. So I'm not thinking of that it's for anybody else. So it's a different kettle of fish. But when I'm writing for someone like Josh Groban, I'm very aware of what he's done before, and I think writers that are trying to aim their songs for people, it's very advisable for them just to listen and just to think of where they're coming from. For me, when I was, you know, writing songs like These Dreams for Heart and We Built the City for Starship, I tended to think
know about the bands, but I would think, what would it be like to put Tom Dolby with Kim Carnes? And when I was writing for Go West, I'd think, well, here's an English funk band that wants to break through in America. Wouldn't it be nice to see if they were doing a Prince track? I'd try and think of that artist, but I'd also try and think of something which I'd love to imagine them joining with. And then you sometimes come up with something a little more unique that the band likes themselves, because most artists want to move on. For instance, when Josh Groban, on his last record, did my song Mi Morena, it wasn't really anything he'd totally done before. It was very romantic, but it had a different kind of feel for him, which he was trying to lean towards. So it was a little more, so he's contemporary. So I think, don't just copy the artist you're writing for. Think about them, but think about what's going to be a little even more intriguing to make the A&R man and the artist themselves think, we should do this, because this is us moving forward, not just doing the same stuff.
So kind of,
I was going to say, do you have any strategy when you're looking at the trades and the record, and let's say one record label has a really big act, and you know the other labels are going to want somebody like that?
Yeah.
Do you sit and go, okay, I need to write for that person. They just made it big, because I know that, you know, label B and C are going to want to create a
It's a great meeting. Point, because most of the A&R departments start looking for that. I'm published by Bug Music, and they send out a flyer every month, you know, and they're very aware of what's the new thing that's happening now. And they'll let you know, this is the kind of style that we need. And you can see it's a trend, you know. And I haven't really been writing for people consistently in that way as I did through the 80s and 90s. I've been concentrating on writing for myself and my solo career. But it's a very good – in those times, and I would advise it now, you tend to say, this is what's going down at the moment. You know, it's that people like this kind of feel. I'll try and integrate that, because it'll get me through the door if I'm writing for other people. You have to be aware, I would say. You have to be aware. Without a doubt.
But there's a risk also, and that is if you, because I've run into this a lot in some of the R&B stuff I've done recently. If it's one thing to follow general trends, but if something is too specific, like Outkast, you know, they basically blew up huge a while ago, and all of a sudden everybody was looking for stuff that sounds like Outkast. Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is that was very, very unique, very stylized. And if you're writing in that kind of style, by the time you place that material, it's going to be out of style. Oh, you have to worry about doing something that's so unique.
That's the point I'm trying to say about bringing, you know, think about what people are doing, then think, what is creative to join to that?
Right, but still do what's right for you.
But you look at, like, Hilary Duff, Avril Lavigne, Lindsay Lohan. I mean, some of these songs they're all...
They're interchangeable.
They're interchangeable. I mean, it's something like, I'm not sure whose album that is. They all kind of sound similar, but, like, that's part of the Disney machine. Mm-hmm. And there are machines out there that are actually trying to say, we're going to make you a hit.
Sure.
That is predictable. It may not last the test of time, but hey, it lasted 3 to 4 months. It made it made it big. Everyone made their money, and next.
So let's see what we got here. We've talked about inspiration and about grabbing your lyric, and we've talked a little bit about production and the pre-production, which really is with the cassette, you know, and learning how to edit yourself, being honest with yourself. And then we talked about once you go into production and you start recording.
There's a good point in between that, Mike, that you just made me think about. Also, get feedback from people you trust. You know, if you've got somebody that you trust, whether it's a manager or a friend or somebody that you really know, they trust their ears and they're truthful people, it's really good to get feedback.
So,
not with multiple people, because you'll get confused. But somebody you trust. Try and find a few people that you respect. I think that's important.
And also, I think it's important. We have in-house composers at our facility that I've brought on to support the gaming world. And one of the things we did when I had about 5 different composers, and I really wasn't sure they were all very good and unique, I actually collected about 20 people who weren't in the business, you know, accountants, different people of different ages that I thought were appropriate. And we just did a blind test.
Yeah.
We just played them the music and said, which ones, who do you think are the composers that are just popping out to you? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Out of 5 people, everybody picked 2 of them. Mm-hmm. They just gravitated towards those 2. Mm-hmm. And I get about a dozen.
Did you fire the rest?
We never hired them. But I get about a dozen demos a week. I get a lot of demos. Mm-hmm. Because people, especially when they want orchestral music or underscore music. And it's interesting that I've seen some great writing and some lousy production. and where people are trying to do string sections by playing string runs on a synthesizer, and it's just terrible. And there's so many great tools out there that I think I'm also suspect or guilty that when you hear a demo that's got great production and it's also just great music and it takes you somewhere, all of a sudden it just pushed an emotional button. It's wide. It feels – you just want to listen to it. You want to listen to it again and again and again. You know, those are the demos that all of a sudden I gravitate to. And recently, I unfortunately don't get a chance to listen to all the demos that come in. Mm-hmm. I'd pretty much be a full-time job.
Yeah.
But this one guy who was a friend of a friend, and he kept bugging me, and it took me about 6 months to listen to it. And then literally I just popped the CD in, and I heard it, and it blew my mind. I mean, it was really great film score. It wasn't everything like John Williams-esque. It had more interesting – the guy was from Middle East, so it had some really interesting European and different vibes to it. I literally called him up and hired him.
Yeah.
After 6 months, he's like, oh, you finally heard my demo. I said, this is great. I want to meet you. Come on in.
I think that brings up a good point that, you know, you have to be aware of what people are listening to, because their first attitude is like, we want to sell this and there's a trend going on. But it is really important that your demos do sound a little unique. And there are some, you know, a sense that you've moved a little forward, because in my experience, the songs that I had cut always weren't totally written for somebody. You know, in fact, These Dreams, recorded by Heart, was written for Stevie Nicks. Bernie Taupin had written that lyric specifically for her, and you can see it in the way he wrote the lyrics. But and I didn't really demo it for Stevie Nicks yet, but Heart heard it a different way. And you know, every time I've sat down and been told to write something purely for a film or, a certain project, it's been difficult because you're already nailed down. My best success has been not really thinking too deeply about who I was writing for, and then you may come up with something which is totally unique to you, and somebody else hopefully sees it for that.
It you can't fake it. If you're writing something that isn't true to you, it's not going to come across. It's not going to ring.
Has anybody, have you ever written a song for somebody and they taken it in a place that you didn't like?
Oh, I all the time. You know, I mean, I hated We Built This City when they brought me down the studio to hear it, you know, and everybody was so excited about it. And I had this demo of it, which I'd done on an 8-track Fostex, which really had a different kind of attitude and groove to it. It sounded very much like in a way, I was basing it around kind of the Shock the Monkey Peter Gabriel vibe.
It was a little darker.
Ever so dark, and you hear on the record they've got a DJ talking in San Francisco, but I picked up on a radio station a police report for a riot going down on downtown. I thought, this is fantastic, you know. And Bernie's lyrics had a really an ominous feel about them, so my demo was very dark. So when they called me up and said, you've got to come down the studio and hear this, I was, you know, I thought, thrilling, you know. And I went down there and I heard it and I thought, God, it sounds like a German march, you know. It was so unfeeling to me. But as soon as it went number one, I thought it was great. Terrific record.
That's really good. Well, hey, listen, I just want to get back on track for a second. When you're doing your demos, let's see, we got in with getting some feedback from other people.
I can tell you what I think is another of the most important steps of doing your demo, and that is the rehearsal process. If you're going to be having any kind of live band performance, or you're going to have any kind of humans gelling with each other, a big mistake that people make is not working that stuff out in rehearsals before you actually hit record.
Well, that's a good idea.
It's not hard, and for any kind of – it's a shame Andrew Sheps isn't here now, because we've actually worked with some live bands together where Andrew is such a stickler about the rehearsal process, and it turned out to make such a huge difference. If you go in the studio and you're in the stress and pressure of recording a demo, even if it's just for your own enjoyment – you're not going to experiment. You're not going to work out when should the drummer go to open hi-hat. When should he go to the ride cymbal? You know, things like that. You need to be able to figure out those things when there isn't pressure.
And
your demos will be a lot better.
You know,
do
it where you're not paying for it.
Do it in the cheap rehearsal room.
What do you think about the people like bands like White Stripes? Mm-hmm. Some of it's kind of the big garage bands that are doing some...
It's a lot easier with just two people in the group.
You know? Yeah, but you know, you listen to their stuff and everything there sounds like a garage demo, but they're doing it live and everyone, you know, but
the problem is
to it,
when something's as unique as they are, there's going to be them, and then there's going to be a lot of copycats of them. And if those copycats don't advance the art form, they're going to be forgotten. So, you know, if you can come up with a niche as unique as they did, that's excellent.
Okay, so the thing that I want to ask you guys, we're going back to talking about demoing from songwriting, and I want both Rob, your opinion, and Martin's, and Scott, too.
They're at Bobby's.
Not Bobby. Bobby's not here.
We can get him on the phone.
No, and this gets back to self-editing, but what about people who have great songs, and they have great production, but their voice really, really stinks? I've heard demos where the song's actually really good, but they just didn't have the courage, I guess, to replace themselves with someone who could sing.
Well, were they trying to write it for themselves as an artist?
No, they were trying to sell it.
Oh, well, then that's a huge mistake.
I mean,
yeah, you've really got to have somebody that you trust tell you. You know, that's why we were talking about having feedback. Somebody needs to say, great song. And I've recently been dealing with that, where there's been a writer who's been sending me stuff and looking for feedback. And I had to say, you know, he was going to, you know, he said, I'll take my voice off. I'll put another singer on. But I even had to say, you know, go back with the song doesn't even need to be recorded yet because there are some other things wrong. But if you have a great song and you're not performing it, you need to be very truthful and faithful to the song. The song has to speak the loudest. And you have to get feedback. You may not know that you're not singing well, but usually you will. Usually you'll get a sense, like, even for myself, I think, this isn't the kind of song that I shine in. So let me try and find a vocalist who does, you know. I would maybe be writing an R&B song, and I think the guy from Go West will sing this so much better than me. I've got the core melody. I understand it like a Motown song, but I need somebody who understands R&B. So it's important for you to know your limitations, and you have to be very brave to find another singer to sing it. And think again, this leads to finding the right singer to sing it. You know, you have to think about the kind of artist you need to demo it for you.
So when you did These Dreams, did you have somebody like Stevie Nicks, husky female vocal?
In fact, no. And here's a great example again. I sang that demo myself, but it really didn't sound like Heart. It was sounding like Orchestra Maneuvers in the Dark, you know, very atmospheric, very hymnal. But obviously, I'd got to know this again. This is a good thing for songwriters. I had a relationship with Peter Wolf, who was a keyboard player who was about to work with this band, and so I gave him some demos, and he was trying to advance them into a slightly different style. So my demo of These Dreams wasn't, even though it was Bernie's lyric for Stevie Nicks, I demoed it very much my own style, which was very much Orchestra Maneuvers in the Dark. Right. Yet I could tell when I did it that it had a hymnal quality, and so I thought, Bonnie Raitt or Kim Carnes would be... In fact, Kim Carnes cut the song, but it was too rangy for her. Songs take very, very different... a lot of different journeys, but again, as Rob said, you know, I was true to the atmosphere of the song. And luckily, my relationship with the producer said, let me play this to Heart. The girls in Heart heard it and said, even though Ron Nevison, the producer, said, I don't think this is right for them, it's synthesizer-based. And in fact, if you listen to the song and you look at These Dreams, although on the demo they're strumming guitars, there's not a guitar on it. It's really a hymn. I did sing that demo myself, but when I'm doing songs maybe for when I was writing for the Commodores or if I was writing for Earth, Wind & Fire, I might say, let's bring in a soul singer that's going to, you know, give the inflections that I'll never get as a white, you know, here's a white boy being, you know, trying to pull it off. I've got the idea, I've got the vibe, but I know somebody else finds this much more natural. And I play guitar on my demos, but sometimes I feel like, it'd be lovely, as Rob said, to bring in a guitarist who's just going to play it with a few more flourishes, which give you a real ethnic feel.
And why not? I mean, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's collaborative. It's great. It's not like you're giving away anything. I mean,
But that great point you brought up is so important that we've been talking about, is don't record until you're ready. Do not, you know, under-rehearse. Rehearse it. Be ready. You know, so many demos are done, and you look... How many demos did we do when we first started, where we look back and we go, something's wrong? And yet I finished it. I spent so much time on it. The bridge isn't as good as it should be. You know, it's that lust to get going. You have to be slow, and you have to be steady and build a good ship before you put it out to sea.
And it really is hard.
It's hard to learn that.
I don't know a fast way to learn that.
Well, let me tell you, we're running out of time here. But before we go...
Maybe you are. I've got plenty of time.
Yeah, I want to go on. I'm into it, Rob. I'm feeling good about it.
We haven't even started to talk about how loud those demos should be.
You know, the first half of this show...
I want everybody out there to tell us what their volume should
be. You remember, the first half of this show, Rob, was all bloody Mike, wasn't it? It was Mike Rodriguez's show. I mean, I've traveled so far, a long way to do this. And what have we had, 10 minutes? It's not good enough.
Max.
You guys done?
How you done?
You're the one editing this thing. You tell us. Sometimes the music just kicked in.
Well, hey, the one thing I can get out of this whole thing is...
You got one thing out of this whole thing? Oh, we are screwed.
We are in trouble.
Minus 20 equals 20.
No, but basically is everything kind of points to having a respect for the song. Because if you're going to be a songwriter and you're going to... You know, you want to record your song, you want to sell your songs. It sounds like that you want to have the respect to rehearse your songs. I look at
and
you,
patience.
Yeah,
patience
but I look at, I actually both, I'm about to pay you a compliment, so just be good.
I'm waiting.
No, but I look at both you and Rob and your songwriting. If there's one thing that I can really sense is you have a really good, healthy respect for your craft, especially you, Martin. You know, when I've been around you while you're writing some of your songs, it's really great to see that you have that kind of respect. And Rob, too, you know, when you're writing your scores and things like that, I mean, you're really serious, I know, because I try to call you when you're working and I get a little...
Yeah, that doesn't work out. Yeah.
So well. Talk now, gotta go bye.
So if you're out there and you want to be a songwriter, I think you just really need to take it seriously.
You have to take the song more seriously than even your own ego. Yeah, it comes back to the thing Martin was saying about don't sing your own demos if you have a terrible voice. Mm-hmm. You know, the song is paramount. The song is everything. So if you're not a good conga player, not a good singer, not a good anything, get other people to collaborate with. Yeah. Make the song the focus and you'll do well. There's so many demos that have been destroyed by ego. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Yeah. And it's as you say, I think that's the biggest thing. If you're absolutely enthused about songwriting, and you've got that passion that you really you're motivated by the song. You know, I know as a kid I bought records not totally because of the artist, but I think what inspired me first was I liked the tune, I liked the song. When I bought the record, I didn't really know the artist. I learned about the artist after. It was the way the song and the record hit me. So I think that's the biggest thing. It is as you say, respect for the song.
I just want to say that, and Martin, I know you didn't know that I'm going to do this, but, you know, Martin practiced.
Happy birthday.
Not again! God, I only had one a couple of weeks ago.
No, but I'm going to spill the beans a little bit, but Martin actually does phenomenal demos and he records everything he does, and he's going to be releasing an album with some new stuff and some of his demos, and they're just phenomenal pieces that
he's
recorded. And I just wanted to break something.
No, thank you, Mike. I'm looking forward to putting it out, and I'm very excited about it. Thank you.
And what we're going to do is we'll probably spend some time on another show, and maybe we'll bring in some of your demos so that you can show people that it's not just, it's not just lip service that you have.
God, it's going to be hard playing the demos to you lot.
But you know what? I think that was a really great idea of you. You know, he has this just amazing back catalog of all these demos of all these songs that he's written for artists that have recorded some of them but that haven't recorded other ones. And they sound so good. And he's actually listening to some of that stuff that kind of inspired me to like, hey, we should talk about this, because your demos are just top notch.
It just feels like that time in my career as well to release a lot of the stuff that I've held back that I would just be thinking, oh, there'll be a time for them to come out. But now the time feels right now. And I was always a great fan of Pete Townshend's Scoop albums where they didn't totally finish them totally up the way that, to be played by the band. So it's important for me to let go of some of this stuff in its raw form, and I'm looking forward to that because it'll be good for me. I very rarely release stuff that isn't finished, so this is quite a therapeutic kind of thing.
Well, the other thing too, and then I'm going to stop spreading all these compliments on you, but really the melodies, Martin, you're really great master of melody. So if you want to hear some really good melodies when the album gets released at the end of summer sometime?
I hope to. I hope to be finished by around September.
It's a great, if you're a songwriter, it's just a great, great piece just to study the songwriting because it's really great. Well, that's about it for today. You guys have anything else you want to say before we go?
I think we've said everything we could possibly say.
Yes.
I'm speechless.
Any more? How about the levels up in Norway or anything like that?
I wonder what the levels are in Iceland. It kind of gets cold.
Well, I just want to thank everybody for listening. And like I said, at the top of the show, the podcast is catching on. We're getting, new listeners every single day. And if you want to be involved with the podcast, if you want to come in while we're taping, if you want to sit on the panel, if you want to ask anybody a question, if you just want to complain, then you can email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Right, till next time, we'll see you.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio.